be separated and segregated from these people on the day of resurrection especially. And we all know that these people are condemned to fire of hell on the resurrection day. May the Almighty Allah set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path and not from these unjust people. Thank you for staying with us, dear listeners. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
I need you by my side. I wish to be the most close to you throughout my life. Ya Allah, oh Allah, be with me all the way. Down, wash away that guilty frown. Falling rain, rising sun. So many things to get done. Time. is high, only you can see. For no one knows but you and me.
Good night to all our dear listeners. You are tuned in to Iran Radio broadcast from Tehran. Very nice to have you with us. I'm hosting you for the next hour. Stay with us into the early hours of this morning. We'll start this hour's lineup with Youth Station. The program is all about young people and addresses topics which are all related to young people. Our varied radio productions feature will follow. And after that, it's time for Minbar. The program covers speeches on a host of subjects by very well-known Islamic scholars and orators. Stay with us for the next hour.
Start.
Movement.
Speak.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station. Youth Station. Youth Station.
Islamati, Allah my Lord,
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran,
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet,
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon,
praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all of time.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. Welcome back to a new episode of Youth Station. This is Arabi English Radio. I'm Asma and...
This is Nahid, having the honor of being with you.
Yes, so we're so happy to be in this studio because Youth Station is home. And once we're here, that means we're home again. This cozy corner of being in the Youth Station is the most pleasurable thing.
Yeah, exactly.
When I look back into my childhood, I feel so proud of being a member of the Islamic world. You know, it's a blessing that we sometimes forget that it's a blessing. It's a real, real gift.
Yeah, and many times we just take it for granted.
Many times, unfortunately, when you have just as health and other blessings that you have, you don't remember how respectful they are up until you lose it.
Or you see the other people. I mean, when I just entered the school as a teacher and I saw the students who, this is like really beautiful, fortunately, I could see the students who love the religion and I could see how they are defending the religion. When I saw those people, I thought and I started asking myself, are you being the same person who can defend the religion the way they are? So when I saw those pictures, I started to work on myself even more. Like, our children are aware and they love their faith. So we are the same. But sometimes we are not showing the picture of our religion. And this is a little bit sad.
Yeah. So the thing that we're talking about is Islam and how we see it and how other people would see it and why we love it. So let's start from the very first point, from the very first square. From the sandbox.
Yeah.
Like when you're a kid, maybe it's immaterial to you what is religion. But as you grow older, as you become a teenager, then little by little your questions are going to rise up. They're going to pop up into your head. The first question you're going to ask is, why am I born?
Yeah.
So to answer this question, inevitably, you have to... find an anchor, and that anchor, the best anchor that you could find is God. No matter where you go, how much you search, that's God.
Yeah, and that safe corner in every question that we face.
Yes.
The questions that are hard for us, complicated, we can't find the answers.
So much.
Yeah, and the only place that we can seek refuge at is just getting nearer to Allah.
Yeah, so you know, I know that in this materialistic world, there are many, many cults and many groups and many, they come and they bring different... ideologies, different perspectives of the creator, of the creatures. But then trust me, all the roads are going to lead you into one direction.
Yeah.
And that direction is God. So in order to get closer to God, you see, it's very, it's much of a delicate and sensitive discussion. Like, because some people would ask, why do you have to have a religion to get close to God, to get this much of closeness with God? But then the answer is, am I potentially having this capability to get close to someone who is the ultimate truth and who is so great and so grave? Do I have this possibility? For sure, as a teenager, no.
Yeah.
Even if I get older, no. Even if I get wiser, no. Because for this greatness, I need a conduit. There must be a mediator. I must have a mediator in between me and him to help me, actually, to show me the way. I actually am not saying that my relationship with God has to have this mediator. Like, I'm not saying that. The chit-chat that we have with God, that's something else. But in order to get closer to him, there's a way. And that way has God gates. And those gates are the infallible imams and the prophet.
Yeah, and with Islam, you can find those ways.
Exactly.
I mean, Islam is the window towards finding those people, those finding the guidance that we are in seek of.
So in today's episode, we're not actually discussing this fact that why Islam? Because after all these episodes, I guess, we already made it clear.
Yeah.
And we came to this conclusion. We believe that. This is at the back of our mind, that everybody who's listening to us has got the same perspective as we have. Like, Islam is the ultimate way of getting closer to God.
Yeah, right.
And Islam is the best religion, and it has completed. You know, we believe that all the religions are one.
Yeah.
And Islam has brought it into its highest peak.
Yeah, and Islam is just the most completed version of the religion that people
have. Yeah, and our prophet, Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, is the last prophet. And after him, there is no prophet who could come and have revelation and all those stories.
Yeah, right.
So the very first fundamental thing that we have got into our brain is that we all believe in Islam as the last and complete version of religion that we have. So now, how do we see it and how we love it? That's the question. We go for a break and then we come back to see it from different perspective.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
Well, sometimes you have something so precious and then you do not recognize it until you see the others.
Yeah.
When you're healthy, you cannot see how healthy you are until you see someone who's blind and who wants to cross the street. At that moment, you say, oh, God, thank you for my eyes.
And, you know, with Islam, what happens is that it's something in our heart. It's the belief. It's the deep sense in our heart. Mm-hmm. And sometimes we forget about our actions. I mean, from the outside, worldly speaking, other religions, other people, non-Muslim communities, are looking at us. And from the outside, Islam looks something sometimes different to them.
Exactly.
I mean, unfortunately, those who are less aware when we talk about Islam to them, they have the picture of those isolated people who are not in the society a lot.
And then look at the policies, like
the
Western politicians try to actually bring scratches into the face of Islam by, in what way? In the way that they created ISIS.
Yeah.
Now, many people, when they look at Islam, they remember ISIS, but ISIS has got nothing to do with
Islam. Yeah, exactly. And they feel like in Islam, women are being oppressed, they are being controlled. And,
they do not study, they are not educated,
and it's so
they
sad
do not go out, they don't have any interaction with the world, but that's Totally the reverse.
Exactly. And it's so sad that from the outside, what they think, what they consider as Islam, as something totally wrong.
Yeah.
And I think one of the reasons, I'm not blaming anyone or anything, but I think the reason is from us. The reason is rooted in us. Those moments that we forget that we have to act based on Islam, I mean, those moments that we forget our responsibility to inform the world of Islam of how life is in this religion,
yeah.
They can be the reasons.
So we're here to bring some perspective.
Yeah.
One of them, the first thing that is very interesting is that if you look at history in Islam, we have never been interested for broadening our territories with war.
Yeah.
The prophet was the prophet of kindness, and he was actually assigned to complete the realm of manners.
Yeah, and
he was the
prophet
of manners. He was so kind. He answered all the misbehaviors with him, all the cruelties that happened to him in his journey. With too much of kindness.
And you know, Asma, the best kind of invitation that was done by our prophet was his action.
Exactly.
I mean, sometimes without even saying anything, he could invite people to his religion by just acting the sample of what God has taught him.
So, the first thing I'm so proud of is my prophet.
Yeah.
My prophet has always been kind, and he's the symbol of kindness. He's the beloved of God for his behavior, for the way he talked to people, for the way he felt for human beings. Like a prophet crying at the very heart of the night for other people who are hurting him. This is too much.
Yeah.
This is too very much. And then asking God in all the occasions, the only thing that he cares for is the people, the human beings.
Yeah, right.
And he actually does not draw a line. These are my people and the others are the people of the other religions. I don't care for... No. Our prophet was kind to Jews, was kind to Christians, to all the human beings. Yeah, there is no single account that tells you our prophet actually created a line border between he himself, his people, and the other people.
Even with those people who were insulting him.
Exactly.
He had that noble character, and he had always advised Muslims to be the same. He says, the best of you is the best of Muslims is the best one in character.
Yeah.
He mentions that we have to keep the same character, though we can't be like him, but we can get those features. We can practice
those features.
Yeah, at
least we can learn. We can practice.
Yeah, people were insulting him in the face, and still, he was the prophet of Allah. He had the power. He could just nag and complain about people to the creator, but he still kept the same noble person.
And he cried for these people who are hurting him.
Yeah, and he
asked
them to
Allah
be saved.
To forgive them.
Yeah.
So this is too much. And the other point about him, about the greatness of our prophet, is that our prophet brought women into the spotlight.
Yeah.
Like he was the one who helped women be considered as human beings. He was the one. And by the way, there is one thing which is very important. All the infallible imams are coming from his daughter, the daughter of the prophet.
Yeah, exactly.
So it was a girl who brought all these great and noble imams into this Islamic heritage.
Yeah, it's like after the prophet, the person who started this tradition of our imams is his daughter. So the daughter is keeping the flag of our prophet.
Yeah. So this is another greatness of our religion.
Yeah, right.
In no other religion, I don't think there is such a thing like what the prophet did. Caring for women, bringing them into the spotlight, making the world aware of the role of women
and
of the ladies
women.
And of the values of women.
Every group of society, once they know the character, once they know how our prophet was behaving, they realize that this person, this character is respected, regardless of the religion.
So another point is equality. Another point that I would want to mention is justice in Islam. you are equal to each other, and the only thing that makes you better than the others is your piety, is how kind and how loyal of an obedient of God you are. These are important facts that you may not find in other religions. And that's why we call Islam as the complete religion of God. And we're proud of it. By the way, only 14 minutes is not going to do the justice to the discussion for why I love my religion and why I love my prophet and the picture of Islam. But this was just the maybe the introduction to some other episodes in Youth Station, which is a very interesting discussion. Yes, I'm a Muslim and I love my prophet and I'm so proud of my religion because my religion is the religion of dignity, of compassion and of kindness.
Yeah, our Islam is our voice, our smile and our walk. So we have to be the beauty of our faith wherever we go. Until the next time, wassalamu alaikum
wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I will tell you, dear youth, that the future belongs to you. By Allah's favor, you, dear youth, will see that day and you will hand down your sources of pride to the future generations. Greetings be upon you and Allah's mercy and blessings.
And inshallah, we will continue talking about this.
We'll discuss that inshallah in the next session. Wassalamu alaikum.
Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. And don't go away.
We will continue this very essential topic with our great youth.
Wassalamu alaikum. Wassalamu alaikum. Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast round the clock for listeners across the globe. The English channel of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting can be heard via shortwave, internet, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,710 kilohertz every day on 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in the Southern Africa can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 11,740 kilohertz every day on 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Iran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the English channel of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is iranradio.ir. You can also listen to the radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means.
Thank you.
In the United Nations building in New York, there is a never-ending stream of shocks and horrors that pass over diplomats' desks. And in recent years, those shocks and horrors seem to be escalating to new levels. The conflict in Ukraine, the apocalyptic scenes of Gaza, and the 12-day war between Iran and Israel, the specter of wider global conflict lurks ever-present. To discuss all this today on the Moscow Report, I'm speaking to Dmitry Polyansky, the Deputy Russian Ambassador to the United Nations. In particular, focus is the recent war between Iran and Israel and what role Russia is willing to play to secure peace in the region. Mr. Polyansky, thank you for joining me. First of all, were you shocked? Have you been shocked the last year or so from the images of Gaza? And how keen is the delegation of the Russian Federation to end what's happening there?
Well, of course, we all were shocked and we continue to be shocked and demanding immediate ceasefire. We think that what is happening in Gaza is absolutely unacceptable. And Russian delegation was the first one to propose draft resolution demanding immediate ceasefire. It was 1 week after the events of 7th of October 2023. So we are very consistent and we are coordinating our efforts with our Arab partners and all those who are not willing to close their eyes on what's happening there.
And what is it like in the corridors of the United Nations? Obviously, you've got conflicts, wars, constantly going through the building. Is there something different about what's happening in Gaza? Is there more of a feeling amongst many people there that this has to stop, or is it just another conflict?
Well, it's very disturbing for everybody to see what's happening. And you need to take into account the fact that UN is first and foremost a dialogue platform, bringing together different countries and opinions, and if there is a consensus, if there is a desire to move forward, then UN can envisage certain action, including by the use of force in accordance with Chapter 7 of the UN Charter. But otherwise, it all boils down to discussions and exchange of opinions, condemnation, emotions, and of course it affects a lot of people, a lot of my colleagues who are very desperate and anxious because of the fact that we were not able to make difference on the ground, to bring about any practical result, regardless of the fact that we all were working painstakingly and we consider to work painstakingly on such a scenario. But you know that the Security Council was blocked by the U.S. delegation on many occasions as far as Gaza situation is concerned.
And in terms of the 12-day war, as it's being called, between Iran and Israel, how concerned was the Russian delegation in that conflict? People like Jeffrey Sachs, the renowned academic, said that war with Iran would be World War III. How concerned were you, and indeed are you, as the conflict might start again, of war between Israel and Iran?
Well, first of all, we were predicting that such developments is not excluded. Because of the way the events folded out, Gaza provocations, inflammatory rhetoric, all this in combination left very little grounds for optimism. And we were repeatedly telling about this during our meetings on the topic of Gaza, on Lebanon, on other issues. We were also very much concerned by the fact that some Western delegations were trying to bring more emotions about this file in Vienna and working in the IAEA to kind of create atmosphere which would be very dangerous. And this was visible. This was coming. This was looming. And that's why we were absolutely correct when we said that the region is facing very, very dire times. So unfortunately, we were right. When it all happened, we immediately supported the demand of our Iranian colleagues for emergency Security Council meeting. And I think that we were also very consistent during this meeting, during our interviews, during any statements of our foreign minister, president, official spokesperson, about the fact, about the condemnation of this aggression, unprovoked aggression against Islamic Republic of Iran. And we were absolutely clear and unambiguous about this from day one.
There is some feeling amongst some people, I don't know about the Iranian government, but some people in Iran and indeed internationally, that Russia perhaps didn't do enough for Iran when the conflict started. Obviously, Iran has been quite supportive to Russia. We don't know how or in what capacity in the conflict in Ukraine. But would you accept that or not? Do you think Russia has fulfilled its obligations, if it has any, to Iran?
I would put it this way. We did everything that Iran asked us to do. I think that Iranians can't reproach us of any lack of support, of any ambiguity, and we were all the time supporting Iran at international forums, during Security Council meeting. And I think that that is very important. Our Iranian colleagues here, the permanent mission of Iran to the UN, are very grateful to us, and we continue day-to-day coordination at expert level, and I haven't heard of any reproaches to us or some wishes that we didn't implement.
Russia seems to be trying to strike a balance in the Middle East. Obviously, you have friendly relations with Israel, you have important trade ties with Israel, and of course with Iran. Have relations between the Russian Federation and Israel been damaged over recent years, obviously because of Ukraine, then Gaza, now Iran? How is Russia's relationship with Israel at the moment?
We try to remain in contact with all the stakeholders in the region, and that gives us a unique opportunity for good offices and for reaching out to different players, which I think is very important nowadays. Here we in fact have some kind of a unique position. We are very blatant when we speak with our Israeli colleagues, telling that a lot of things that they are doing are unacceptable. We have been consistently critical of the lack of desire and readiness from Israel to implement the decisions of International Community, Security Council, General Assembly, as regards the creation of independent Palestinian state. And we're not ambiguous about this. On the other hand, we have some practical issues that we discuss in our bilateral relations with Israel. We have to bear in mind that a big proportion of Israelis are Russian speakers, and they originated from the countries of the former Soviet Union. So they share, to a large extent, they share a mentality, and we have a lot of things in common. This is a factor which we can't ignore, and we try to be balanced again. But it doesn't mean that we want to kind of be politically more polite or put something, sweep something under the rug because of some practical consideration with that or that side of conflict in the Middle East.
The United Nations, you see quite a bit of Iranian diplomacy up close. Right now, there's some confusion or ambiguity about whether Iran wants to negotiate. Do you feel the Iranians want to find a deal with the Americans to try to find a long-lasting solution to the nuclear program and indeed peace in the region?
My impression is that Iran was always open. Iran was always ready to find a solution. It was not Iran which triggered this whole degradation of situation around JCPOA. We all remember that it was the decision of the previous Trump administration to withdraw from this deal, which started all this circle of problems. And we still call it during relevant meetings of the Security Council. We don't want it because the United States and its Western partners, they usually try to, say that all the problems emanate from the actions of Iran, forgetting that these actions were retaliatory, and that they could be easily reviewed. And for many months and even years, everybody was trying to find a way forward with the JCPOA. But unfortunately, it was not the case. I always felt from my colleagues at the Iranian mission genuine desire for diplomacy. They were always ready. They were calling spade a spade, of course, as everybody concerned about the true source of this crisis. And here, of course, they were not on the same page with the United States and other countries, but they were on the same page with the truth, and that's most important. So I'm not aware of which role Iranian mission, for example, plays, if it does play any role in bilateral contacts, direct or indirect, with the United States. I simply don't have this kind of knowledge. But I know that as far as the UN agenda is concerned, Iranian mission here is very active. They have very professional diplomats, very professional and respected ambassador who has a lot of contacts, and we assist them. We always maintain close contact at all levels, and frankly, I don't recall any contradictions or any problematic issues that we didn't manage to solve in a very partner-like way through diplomacy, mostly at expert level. I think that's how the missions should interact here in New York.
And how, just to give us some inside kind of picture, how do the Iranians and the Americans, for example, interact with the United Nations? I mean, do they interact at all? Do they have any honest dialogue in the corridors?
I haven't seen any dialogue between Iranian mission and U.S. mission. If it takes place, well, first of all, we do not monitor it, of course. We do not stalk Iranians or Americans about their contacts, and we hope that nobody stalks us on what we're doing or not doing. I recall at some point of time there was very historic reaching out, I think, of Linda Thomas-Greenfield to the Iranian ambassador front of the cameras, only once that I remember that it was happening. Otherwise, I think that there is no direct interaction, but they very often are present during the same meetings. They are sitting at the same horseshoe table, and they do not address each other directly, but this crosstalk is not kind of a tradition of the Security Council meetings, especially closed meetings. That's why Iranian delegation behaves in the way it should behave. And again, I can't really account for any direct interactions that I was aware of between them. Usually it's just, you know, in the framework of the Security Council meetings, which involve these two countries.
There was a lot of hope when the new Trump administration took power. He was very clear that he wanted peace both in Ukraine and in the Middle East. Do you get a sense that there is a change of American policy, or is it simply more of the same?
No, it's hard to say at this stage, because frankly, we don't understand at this moment quite clearly what is the new U.S. Foreign policy, including towards the UN, because there are a lot of signals that United States is in favor of scaling down expenditures here in the UN, doing away with red tape, all these things that we all share. But devil is in the details, of course. So far, we don't have a new U.S. ambassador, Mr. Waltz. As far as I know, he wasn't even affirmed by the Congress at this stage. The current acting head of mission does her best. She reflects the priorities of the Trump administration. But everybody understands that a new ambassador who has Mr. Trump's ear and direct contact maybe would give us more clarity about the priorities of the new administration. So far, they are very blurry and controversial. And I think that U.S. foreign policy still is very mercurial and hard to predict. These policies are in the making, and I hope that at some moment we will better understand what will be the line of the United States in the world and in the United Nations. So far, it's not very clear.
Because it seems under Biden, everybody knew what they were getting. It was very clear their policy on Ukraine. They wanted the war to continue on Israel. But Trump, you do get a sense as a diplomat of the United Nations that you don't really know what American policy is.
On certain things, it's predictable. Like in the Middle East, I think it was predictable from day one. There are, of course, nuances in approaches of two administrations, but in general, the pattern remains the same. It's the safeguard of Israeli interests and support of Israel as the main key ally in the Middle East. Some other files were predictable. I think that Iranian file as well was one of the most obvious, targets of Trump administration, given his previous record and given his personal positions. On some other issues, like, for example, Ukraine, still there are very many emotions and very, I would say, little consistency sometimes, because we have repeatedly told President Trump at several levels and his team that in order to achieve a long-lasting peace, sustainable peace in Ukraine, we need to address the root causes of this crisis. And this was the core of our approach, and this still is the core of our approach. Sometimes we have the impression that U.S. side is understandable, is understanding to this obvious thing. Sometimes, if we try to analyze some other statements, there are a few reasons to believe in such a way of thought. But again, it's all in the making.
And do you think Russia and Iran both, in a way, have been fooled by the thoughts of peace talks from the United States? Do you have faith still in peace talks with the United States over Ukraine? And do you think Iran could still have faith in peace talks with the United States over their policy?
Look, we are diplomats, and we should be mindful of positions of the other side, and we need to find compromise by at the same time defending and safeguarding our own positions. So we have no illusions that the Trump administration and President Trump himself, when he makes any move, he is first and foremost guided by the U.S. interests. It would be strange if by acting so, he would be guided by Russian interests or Ukrainian interests or Iranian interests. Everybody has its own interests. So that's why we have no illusions about this. We understand that President Trump, as far as Russia and Ukraine are concerned, we have the impression that President Trump has genuine desire to stop this war, these hostilities, and to bring the situation to the peaceful course of the events, for reasons that may be not very much clear and which may not be totally coinciding with our interests. But this is a welcome move, and we from the outset welcomed the desire of Trump administration and President Trump himself to bring about a peaceful solution. Some people, I understand, may be getting impatient in Washington. Some people might be trying to kind of undermine U.S. participation in any peaceful efforts. But the general line, I think, remains still very clear that the U.S. wants to assist Russia and Ukraine in finding a solution to this crisis, and here we are on the same page with the U.S. administration in terms of tactics and in terms of what should be done. But of course, again, devil is in the details, and again, there are too many actors, too many countries which would not be absolutely interested in the true, genuine, peaceful effort to stop hostilities. It's up to them to decide. We know that we can count on our country, on our partners and allies, and that we are ready to have a diplomatic solution to this crisis. At the same time, we are ready to achieve the goals of our special military operation by military means, and that's something that we were consistently reiterating from day one of our special military operation, and we are at the same situation right now.
It's been very sad for me, as a British journalist, I've been reporting on this conflict in Ukraine for the last 3 years, of seeing European policy, how it's damaged British and European interests, in my view, and the standard of British and European politicians doesn't seem to be what it was 20 years ago. I've met incredible diplomats, are some of my favorite people. I've met them, African people all around the world, very nice people. I met some very impressive British diplomats as well. But you may not be able to, you may be too diplomatic to answer this question, but how do you rate the standard of British and European diplomacy now? Is it the standard of it was 20 years ago? Do you believe it is helping to pursue British and European interests?
I think that they have dwarfed very much the standards of diplomacy, and they are based, first of all, on Russophobia. That's quite clear, and they were based on phobia even before the start of our special military operation. They lack a strategic vision, that's also for sure. I recall dealing with British and European diplomats 20 years ago, the strategic vision. They had an understanding of where they are heading, why they need Russia, why they need to cooperate with Russia. It doesn't mean that they were fond of Russia. It doesn't mean that they were supportive of what we are doing. They were critical on certain things. We were critical on many other things, which, by the way, came true. Everything that we were critical on, predicted, it materialized. But now it's very difficult to speak to the European diplomats, with a very few exceptions. And regardless of the fact that the UK had very considerable, I would say, and respected diplomatic school, now it's very hard sometimes to speak the UK diplomats, because instead of being a diplomat, they turned into some kind of propagandists and Russophobes. Of course, it's very hard to find any common grounds with such people, even for us. They were betting on Russia being defeated. I don't know who kind of introduced this kind of strategic delusion in their hands, in their heads, but many of them are still sticking to this absolutely futile concept, and I don't know when will they be cured out of it. So on such basis, of course, it's very hard to find any understanding, any common ground, but I believe that at some point we will be able to come back to normal, at least dialogue, and at least when Europe will more or less group its strategic interests and priorities, which would help us a lot.
Do you believe that Britain, the British and European governments, and indeed missions, diplomatic missions, are acting in British and European interests? It seems to many, including myself, that they are not acting in British and European interests, and even your president, Vladimir Putin, I think perhaps is even confused into this. Why is Britain and Europe not acting in their national interests? It doesn't seem like they are.
It's very hard for me to understand what is the national interests of UK and Europe. Now, I really can't understand what are the motives, apart from very blatant Russophobia and real hatred towards my country. I don't see any kind of, you know, other tunes in their heads. Maybe this is temporary. Maybe this is some kind of illusion. I met a lot of people even here in the UN, from the UK, from Europe, who regret very much this state of things. I will not, of course, tell you their names, because they may face certain problems back home. But there are people who understand that this is not the way it should develop. But so far, we are where we are. And I don't see, in terms of Europe, I don't see even the light at the end of the tunnel, because they still stick to this futile hope of inflicting strategic defeat on Russia. They still stick to this mistaken concept of zero-sum games, that either Russia or Europe should win, and the winner takes it all. We were always, again, this type of concepts. We think that everybody could benefit of our mutually beneficial and good neighborly relations and cooperation, and we were not the ones who spoiled all this. We were not the ones who brought Russophobia into into the bloc. It was the consequence of enlargement of the European Union. It was consequence of people with their agenda, Russophobic agenda, coming there and poisoning the whole narrative of the European Union. It's happened gradually, and unfortunately, Europeans were short-sighted enough to kind of let it happen.
And final question, is it in Russia's interests for there to be peace between Iran and Israel and the United States, and what can you do about it?
Absolutely. This is not only in Russia's interest. I think this is in the interest of the whole world. And we were always saying, and we continue to say, that we would be very much interested in the direct dialogue between United States and Iran to find the way out of the current crisis. We are ready for any format to support this. We stick to the JCPOA. We stick to other situations. We think that Israel has the right to exist, and Israel has the right to live in security with its neighbors. So this is one of the basic facts that we always say. But at the same time, it shouldn't neglect the plight of Palestinian people. There should be a two-state solution. It should be, and this is something that would entail, I think, a lot of good things for the region as such, because the fact that Palestinian issue is not settled is something that prevents a lot of positive processes to happen in the Middle East or elsewhere. So this is the key key to every door or every positive door in the Middle East. But so far, what we hear from Israel, from the United States, is not very encouraging, because two-state solution as a concept is not popular in both countries, and it's our task to kind of reinvigorate the true diplomatic efforts to the sustainable and fair solution of many problematic issues in the Middle East, including the Iranian issue, including the issue of two-state solution, Lebanon, Yemen, you name it. There are a lot of, unfortunately, crisis situation in the Middle East, and all of them are pinned on the fact that Palestinian problem remains an open wound for the region, and people feel it. And so this sense of injustice, of course, is dominating the emotions and any prospects for finding sustainable peace to the whole of the Middle East.
Be free when we believe it. Believe any thoughts fall and a higher. The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladheena amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of RIB English Radio, now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Amin Rastani.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. That last inspiration that we want to take, inshallah, from the day of Ashura, I felt would be good to be that of death itself, and that everything is going to end, brothers and sisters. I want to share with you some hadiths, inshallah, as much as I can today. As many hadiths as I can that speak of this the importance of this death. Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam says, "Dhikr al-maut yumitu al-shahawat fil-nafs." This is why it's important. Remembrance of death, he says, takes the life of, destroys, kills, the shahawat that we have in us, those carnal desires that we have in us. You see, if I'm going to be here forever, then I have an inclination towards here. And the desires I may have are desires that I will try my best to satisfy in any way possible, if it's halal or haram. The only way these pleasures will slowly lose meaning and color to me is how? Is if I remember that they're going to end. The only thing that reminds me that they're going to end is death. So the Imam, he says, "Yumitu shahawat fin nafs." And that's why we have a famous hadith by the Holy Prophet that he refers to as death as hadimul ladhat. Hadim comes from destroyer. Destroyer of pleasures, it's called death. وَيَقْطَعُ مَنَابِتَ الْغَفْلَ. It says, remembrance of death destroys the roots of heedlessness and forgetfulness. If you were to think about anything else, talk about anything else, go anywhere else, it wouldn't have the power of killing the shahawat in you like death does. Now, of course, when it says shahawat here, those haram pleasures that we seek. If it's halal, Allah has allowed it, it's not a bad thing. يُرِقُّ الطَّابْعَ يَكْسُرْ or يَرُقُّ الطَّابْعَ وَيَكْسِرُ أَعْلَامَ الْهَوَى. It softens one's nature. يَرِقُّ probably comes from رَقِيق and رِقَّة, which means when something's soft, it softens one's nature. Like you cool down a little bit. All this pushing and obsession towards dunya, you kind of loosen up when it comes to that. It's a relaxer, or whatever those pills are that you take that relaxes your body. يُطْفِئُ نَارَ الْحِرْسِ. It extinguishes the fire of obsession. وَيُحَقِّرْ الدُّنْيَا. And it belittles the dunya. Younger people, younger guys, sisters, right? We don't expect this. Islam doesn't expect this from you right away. You don't need to go home now and say, oh, okay, let me destroy all pleasures in life in my eyes. No, right? And even if I wasn't going to say